Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for, what day is today? Tuesday, October 17th, 2023. What a day. What a day it's been. So, oh, such a hectic day. So, hi, Dave.
There you go. Hi, Melody. Yes. Happy National Pasta Day.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. That's the Italian in me.
Well, October is National Pasta Month. Today's the day. Pasta lovers everywhere celebrate. Interesting. First reference of pasta is 1154 in Sicily. First attested to in English seven centuries later, in fact.
Wow. You know,
dried and fresh pasta come in several shapes and varieties. There are so many. In fact, according to the Encyclopedia of Pasta, 310 specific kinds of pasta have been documented, identified by over 1,300 names.
Wow.
Yeah. Several pasta shapes and types vary with locale, in fact. For example, cavatelli, known by 28 different names. Depending on the region and town in Italy it's served in. But right now, I'm watching my blood sugar these days, Melody, so I'm avoiding most pastas right now.
Well, you know, I do believe the pasta that they make over there is totally different than what we make here.
Oh, I
think it's the different wheat or whatever, the flour and so forth. Yeah.
And I need to look for freshly imported pasta.
That's what I would do. And I think if you look at the, you know, I think it is, as long as it's not made here.
Yeah. Hey, beautiful. Well, celebrate the day. And while you're
Bread. I mean, when I went over there with the bread, when the flour, I could eat bread over there because they use a different wheat.
Oh,
and
wow.
It doesn't, it's not the stuff they use here. We used to use the same wheat, but they changed it. So,
awful process crap.
No, it's awful.
Glycogenic. Yes. Anyway, you go.
Anyway, we got lots to talk about, and you know what? Things are really heating up over in Israel, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But we have some financial information that we need to go over today too. So. So let's go ahead and get started. We saw gold up just a couple bucks today at $1,923. Silver was up 1% at $22.92. Platinum was up $3 at $907. Palladium was down $8 at $1,161. The USDX today pretty much unchanged at 106.20. Crude oil's up a little bit at 87.26. Paper markets did a reversal. So there's little changes in the paper markets today. The Dow was down 13 points. The S&P was basically unchanged, and the NASDAQ was down 34 points. So not a whole lot. I think the Europe, I clicked the wrong button. The European markets, they were all positive, but barely. You know, they eked out a gain, which made them green. Same way with the Asian markets. They did a little bit better. The Nikkei was up almost 1.25. Hang Seng was up 0.75%. 10-year yield, that popped 4.84%. 4.84%, all based on retail sales. I can't believe, I don't think they're as hot as what they pretend them to be. So let's see, natural gas, 1.5% down, 3.06. So I think the first thing we're going to talk about is the builder confidence, and then we'll hit the retail sales. Let's see, the builder confidence for market for single family homes. Now, this has dropped to the lowest level since January, and we all know why. High mortgage rates. The monthly National Association of Home Builders Housing Market Index dropped 10% to 40. Now, anything below 50, now that's considered negative. And now we're looking at the third straight monthly decline in builder confidence. And, of course, they all point to mortgage rates. We know that those mortgage rates are at a 23-year high. And we're talking a 30-year fixed is well over 7% for the past 2 months. So affordability has fallen to near record lows. And these builders are reporting lower levels of traffic. Buyers, you know, some of these younger buyers, they're all priced out of the market because of these rates. So, Dave, and we've been talking about the housing market for what, 3 years now?
Yeah.
And that it was on the decline even before the rates really began to rise. And
if it hasn't been one thing in that industry, it's been another.
Mm-hmm.
Timber prices during the early days of the pandemic went sky high. Well, look, of the indexes, the housing index's three components, current sales conditions fell 4 points to 46. Sales expectations for the next 6 months dropped 5 points to 44. And buyer traffic dropped 4 points to a very low 26. And to get buyers in the door, builders are, again, using more incentives, especially buying down mortgage rates. It's probably the best thing they can do right now to make particularly mid to higher end homes even barely affordable. About 62, almost two-thirds, 62% of builders reported offering sales incentives during the month, up a little bit from September, and tied with the previous high for this time of year last year in December. In addition, about a third of builders say they've cut home prices. The average discount for that is 6%. So Bob Dietz, who's the home builder's chief economist, says, and he said this last month, I think, the housing affordability crisis can only be solved by adding additional affordable supply. So boosting, and this is a good point, boosting housing production would help reduce the shelter inflation component that's responsible for more than half of the overall CPI increase last month. Anyway, just looking at the four regions in this index, really nowhere. I guess the Northeast looks to be the highest at 50, and in the Midwest, it's 39, followed closely by the West, where it's 41.
Well, you know, it's just the, yeah, I mean, there's not going to be a turnaround for a long time. Oh, maybe a little. We'll see bumps along the way and so forth, just like anything else. But any real meaningful? Yeah. Retail sales, you know, they're spending, but not on housing. Consumers, retail sales came in well above expectations, rose 0.7% on the month. The estimate was 0.3. This is all from the Commerce Department. That was information released today. You know, we still have the gas stations that were helping to propel the headline number, rising 0.9%. as prices at the pump have accelerated. And the so-called control group, which strips out items such as auto dealers, gas stations, office supplies, mobile homes, tobacco stores, for the department's GDP calculations, rose 0.6% as well. But the numbers were not adjusted for inflation. So they indicate that the consumers more than kept up with the price increases. And so on a year-over basis, sales rose 3.8% compared with a 3.7% increase for the CPI, Dave. And let's see.
Sorry, Melody.
That's okay.
Retail report is considered an important factor for the Fed in contemplating future monetary policy decisions. Now, while markets largely expect that the Fed is done raising rates this year, an unexpectedly strong consumer complicates the equation for them. Jay Powell, Fed chair, is expected or scheduled to speak Thursday in New York. A lot of people will be watching closely for some indication about, you know, where he thinks rates may be headed. Federal Open Market Committee next meets in 15 days. Market pricing continues to assume a high degree of certainty that the FOMC will not hike then, November 1st, but still could choose to do so at future meetings, depending on economic data. The implied probability for a December hike of at least 25 basis points moved up to about 43%. Compared with just 34% yesterday. It's according to the CME Group's gauge of Fed funds future markets. Earlier today, Richmond Fed Prez Thomas Barkin said some of the data coming in lately doesn't match with his on-the-ground observations that demand, consumer business demand, seems to be slowing. Barkin's a non-voting member of the FOMC this year, but he told a group of real estate professionals, "We have enough time to see that we've done enough, or if we've done enough, or whether there's more work left to do." We'll see soon, another week or two, third quarter economic growth, GDP growth will be out. Everyone thinks it's going to be strong. Too big to fail, Goldman Sachs analysts raised its outlook today following the retail report, with that company now showing GDP will be at 4% in the third quarter that was recently completed. Atlanta's GDP now was recently at as high as 4.9%. That's probably a tad high. But I guess you can't keep a good country down, can you, Melody?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's how they tell us anyway. That's the story that's been woven to, you know, to fool.
To make us feel good.
Make us feel good so we keep spending our money and come in with big retail numbers. You know? Yeah. So, well, I'll tell you what, we'll be talking about this here in just, I think, you know, some stories when we get to about Biden traveling to Israel. There's a couple of things that's just come out, and that we'll report on. But and it's interesting. Before we get there, the industrial production rises. The Fed reported that industrial production at U.S. factories increased 0.3% in September, above the 0.1 estimate. And that's supposedly even despite these strikes by auto workers. Well, what GM came out today, and they're stopping all their EV manufacturing until 2025. So these numbers are going to change drastically, drastically. Production dropped 0.8% on year-on-year basis in September. Durable goods manufacturing output rose at a 2.3 annualized rate. I just don't buy it, which was offset by a 2.4 pace of decline in non-durable manufacturing. Yeah, I just don't buy all that. You know, just don't buy all that, Dave.
Yeah, it is a head-scratcher, Melody. I agree. You look at some of these numbers and just wonder. Now we're in an almost a daily state of wonderment, though, when it comes to looking at and analyzing and reporting government figures. A lot of them, anyway. You know, a figure from the Commerce Department one week is overtaken by bad news from, say, the Department of Labor a following week. And this happens all the time. And a lot of it's because there's so much noise out there. We'll continue to do our best to try and seep through that noise for you to tell you what we think is important and what you should just, let go of. Now, despite last month's strong showing, manufacturing remains constrained by slowing demand for goods, again, because of higher interest rates. Manufacturing accounts for over 11% of GDP. Although many economists who follow this are saying the worst for manufacturing is likely over. With the Institute for Supply Management's measure of national factory activity rising to a 10-month high just last month. I think that's all from this report, Melody.
All righty. Well, you know, we had wanted to talk about, you know, Biden traveling to Israel, but I think he's probably there day late, dollar short, because already you have the Palestinian Authority president canceling the planned meeting him after the hospital strike.
Oh, the hospital bombing, just horrible.
I also saw where Hamas said that if Israel stops bombing Gaza, that they will release the hostages. So
yeah, I just saw a discussion about that. This one seemingly informed person, former intelligence officer, was saying if the Hamas was really serious about this, that they would have gone through official channels as opposed to leaking it to a cable news company. But let's wait and see.
Yeah, but they usually go through the media, though. I don't, you know, they don't usually go to the higher powers or to the proper authorities. They usually do release stuff to the press. That's how they usually communicate.
Yeah, there's,
because if they did it directly, then they would be able to be found out. So I don't know. I mean, I hope that's the case.
It's both. I mean, and you know, this could be just the trial balloon that they've leaked to the media. It could be, I mean, who knows? There are all sorts of possibilities. It could be just an attempt to, show some, quote, goodwill in the midst of, not a complete international condemnation of what they did last week, but widely so.
I don't think Hamas has any goodwill.
There's very little good about them.
I wouldn't see that. Now, if they're getting pressure from Hezbollah, but then again, you know, there's reports that, I wanted to say this, Dave, is I got a text last night, and texts are texts. People, you know, they all know somebody that goes somewhere in the military and blah, blah, blah. But this one was interesting because, and I paid a little bit of more credence to this. It was a lady her son is a higher military ranking officer. Now, I can't give, don't know the details and so forth. But they pretty much, he told his mother that she needs to prepare, that there will be war. And they have called, I was trying to find the email or the text so I could read it.
We can do it after the break, perhaps.
Yes, we can. All right. We'll be right back, folks. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. And then we'll go ahead and get on with the financial news. But prior to the break, I just was telling you about a text I received from someone I know. And it was the third U.S. strike group is out with warnings to the U.S. to stay out of Gaza-Israel war. It's getting scary these next 24 hours, and it certainly has. I got this last night. It certainly has heated up in the past and during this 24 hours. And they're saying war for sure. Get your stuff ready. All U.S. troops are on alert. And he is in a high rank in military. So, and he sent that to his mother. So. I hope
bringing serious pressure to bear on Israel to let water and food into Gaza.
I saw things from
were bad in Yemen a couple of years ago with that
the worst that humanitarian crisis ever
got involved in. Oh, this could be crazy because this area is a lot smaller.
But you know what? I was reading, and you don't know who to believe or what to believe, so I don't believe any of it. It just, you have to take what makes sense, a little bit of common sense. And is there common sense in this type of a situation? No, there isn't. But you have to do something. But I was reading where Egypt said, hey, we're here to help, but we keep getting bombed. We can't open the border to let assistance through. And they saying it's coming from, you know, Israel saying it's coming from Hamas. Hamas, you know, Egypt is saying it's coming from Israel. So who do you know where it's coming from? I also said that the oil tankers that went through yesterday, the fuel to go through, I heard they were hijacked by Hamas. So, I mean, there's a lot of, we don't know. Who do you believe? You don't want to believe Hamas. But then it makes, then why wouldn't certain things happen? We got, when we, I mentioned it yesterday about Venezuela. We, this government hated Venezuela a few years ago. And now all of a sudden we're lifting sanctions. I said yesterday, why do you think they're lifting sanctions off of Venezuela? They need the oil because they're planning on a disruption and they need the oil.
Yes. Does, timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
You got to believe that. I mean, certainly, calling for the end of the, some of the sanctions if they agree to free elections. I mean, that's one thing. The timing of it suggests strongly that there are other reasons for that approach.
Absolutely. They didn't go back on any of the executive orders that were canceled a couple years ago for our ability to pump more, to drill more. So we're giving it to Venezuela instead of ourselves. And I'm sure the deal is probably a little bit, you know, the Saudis are probably running it, or dictating, you know, what has to be done. Maybe we weren't allowed to. Maybe it had to go to Venezuela, dictated by the Saudis. Who knows? But it's Dave. I think whatever's going to happen, I think we'll see it by the end of the week, one way or another.
Live in dangerous times.
We certainly do. We certainly do. And it's always interesting when you're up in the middle of the night and you watch the news, you really see things and hear things that you don't see during the day. And it puts a different face on a lot of things. So just be safe out there, ladies and gentlemen. And we just pray that they can contain it and Israel doesn't decide to do any type of a ground invasion. And we pray that the Hamas, for whatever reason, releases the hostages. We don't know much about the hostages at all. So, and to me, I think I get why he went there. But Dave,
why he's going there tomorrow.
Why?
Yeah, he's not there yet. He may, in fact, not go.
He shouldn't. I thought he had already left. And pray nothing happens. But if it did, we've got Kamala running the show. And that could probably be... I can't think of a worst case scenario.
I can. His name is Jim Jordan.
No. Kamala Harris is far. I mean, she's not capable of no. Are you kidding me?
No, I'm definitely not kidding you. We could get into an argument the rest of this program.
I mean, do you ever watch the things she says and does? She hasn't done anything.
Have you ever watched the things that Jordan has done?
I'm not a fan of Jordan, but he wouldn't be running the thing. It would be Harris.
Well, you said Harris, you can imagine a worse case scenario than Harris.
Not for this war.
I can think of many more.
No, no. We may as well all just get shelters if she was the one running the show.
That's ridiculous.
It isn't. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I respect women and all that kind of crap, but no.
Well, it's not crap.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, anyway, let's go ahead and talk about spending. Americans like to spend. We know this. But they're spending through their savings. Maybe that's why the retail sales were higher. Reports from the New York Fed, the IMF, spotlighted the divergence of U.S. savings behavior from that of comparable countries. The New York Fed noted that since 2022, the U.S. savings rate dropped below its pre-pandemic average. Savings rates elsewhere remained higher than they were in times before. And that's all the extra money that they got. Let's see what else is in there. An IMF analyst wrote in the World Economic Outlook, among advanced economies, private consumption has been stronger in the U.S. than in the euro area. I mean, you know, these guys have brilliant educations, and it's like, yeah, we could have told you that. I mean, it really doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. I mean, we're a consumer nation, the biggest in the world. And let's see, have been stronger in the U.S. than in the euro area, with households receiving larger fiscal transfers, money from the government early in the pandemic, and spending the associated savings more quickly. Dave.
Well, the question is then, why are American consumers so much more willing to spend savings than people in other developed, wealthier nations?
Because, can I answer that?
Sure.
Because we haven't had a bad day in our lives. And I think people have become, and people have come to depend on things will always be better. We might go through bad times, but things will always be better. And I think we have more debt, more credit cards than any other nation.
Well, the facts bear that out. I think it's hard to argue with that argument. New York Fed economists guess it may be because a larger chunk of American savings came from government payments during the pandemic than what we saw in other nations.
True.
That may be a factor. It's plausible as well. And some economic theory suggests even that people are more willing to spend that kind of unearned windfall, if you will. Plus, IMF analysts note that Americans also benefited from being more insulated from the rise in energy prices from the war in Ukraine compared to our European counterparts. And with all the crazy good news about our labor markets, I think as you said, Melody, people in America with their historical perspective of, you know, home of the land of the free, home of the brave, things will always be better tomorrow kind of thinking. I think, this all comes together with what we're seeing now in the country. I mean, people might tell pollsters they're miserable, as consumer sentiment surveys show, but they sure do seem to be buying a lot of boats. So I don't know. Go figure.
And, you know, it's something else. We've seen time and time again how the government creates, you know, all these bailouts. And people, I don't think people feel as accountable to, if something happens, they don't have a problem walking away. Not everybody, but for a large part, people don't have a problem with, well, you know, I'm just going to spend it. And if I can't pay for it, hey, government does it. So, and the government always comes in and bails out all the too big to fails and everybody else. And it's a totally different mindset anymore. And, we've been conditioned to believe we don't, we want things now. We don't want to save. We don't want to work for something and pay for something later. I mean, when you're having, what were we reading the other day? Was it 10-year car loans or something like that? It's like,
yeah.
I mean, are you kidding me?
I'm telling you, it's with average prices in the higher 40,000s now. I mean, I remember my sister's first mortgage, and my mother's. I think my sister's first mortgage years ago was 20-some thousand. Yeah. My mother's was 30-some thousand. I mean, these are mini mortgages.
Yeah.
Especially for baby boomers, some Gen Xers who were around in those olden days. Crazy.
But you know what? If people didn't buy and pay for those expensive vehicles, guess what? Prices would come down. Well, maybe not. Well, maybe.
Well, in that industry, I think that would, that's the general behavior. I mean, I've never been a great fan of economic theory because, one, there's so much of it, and two, so much of it doesn't work. what they say is going to happen or what should have happened didn't happen because the theory was either wrong or not, or there were other factors at work that maybe weren't considered when developing it. So I
think that's a key thing. You know, when they were developed, things were different.
Yeah.
And things change. And I think we're at a point now where there's going to be some major changes. But we'll have to see. Yesterday, we reported, Dave, that the SEC said, you know, with AI, you know, it's almost 100% sure that there's going to be AI is going to crash the paper markets.
Yeah.
So now you have the SEC is proposing new short selling rules. Why are they proposing these now? Because they know what's coming. They know what's coming.
Yeah, but they're not telling you that in their reasoning.
Yeah. Why would they? The SEC has announced it's adopting new long anticipated rules intended to add transparency to the world of short selling. I thought short selling was illegal, but
used to be.
Yep.
And
yeah, and it should still be. But anyway, saying short selling is some Wall Streeters say short selling is essential for the integrity of markets. That is such a joke. I mean, really, integrity of markets.
It's essential for hedge fund managers.
Yes.
Nobody else.
Yeah, I know. These Wall Streeters also say it, short selling presents a clear and present danger to investors. And at its core, short selling is an investor's bet on the direction of a company's stock price. But instead of a long bet that a stock is going to increase in price, a short is that the price is going to fall. And but due to its mechanics, short selling performed on large scale can artificially lower the share prices, Dave.
And that's exactly. I mean, it's sheer market manipulation. If it's not going to be banned again completely, there have got to be certain threshold levels above which it's illegal. But I think that's just a slippery slope, and we should go back to how it used to be. I mean, these new rules adopted by the SEC are going to require institutional money managers, including hedge funds, to report these large short positions. I don't know what the threshold is to the SEC once a month. Currently, they don't have to. And the SEC apparently will publish a snapshot of the data, giving investors a monthly view of which companies are being shorted, but not who they're being shorted by. And that to me, I haven't thought too much about this, but on the face of it, I mean, that tells me that it's a step short of effectiveness. Should we know who the big shorters are, who are trying to manipulate stocks, just for us to know,
what their conflict might be. The rule's also going to collect data about the terms at which short sellers borrow shares on margin to execute these short trades. That, again, is to provide transparency. So I guess we'll see where this goes. I mean, short of banning short and long selling, I guess it's a baby step in the right direction, mm-hmm. but nothing more than a baby step, ladies.
Day late. Dollar short. Anyway, we'll be back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Bethann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Bethann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other client business this final segment. She's at 1-800-375-4188. Hey, Bloomberg's Joe Wiesenthal writes in his blog today that if you read the monthly ISM manufacturing report, which we alluded to earlier today, there's a section they look at what key commodities are deemed as scarce in a given month. The good news, he says, is that over the last year, the number of things in short supply have fallen quite a bit. But one category that's been in a particularly persistent shortage is electrical components. In fact, for 36 straight months, 3 years, ISM respondents have said that electrical components have been in short supply. Transmission products are also consistently identified as being in shortage. As of the last report, they've been identified for 2 straight months now. Obviously, Wiesenthal argues, this has all kinds of ramifications for the process of electrification, particularly as part of any energy transition, however you agree or disagree with it. Electric vehicles are a big part of this story in our country. This morning, the International Energy Agency is out with a new report on the role of electricity grids as part of the energy transition. There's a section in the main document about the persistent stress on electricity grid supply chains. Big part of the issue here is simply that there's a lot of key demand for the commodities that go into all these parts as a result of this investment. Wiesenthal points to a key paragraph that reads, the availability of GOES, G-O-E-S, it stands for grain-oriented electrical steel, has a significant impact on transformer production. In 2020, the global manufacturing capacity of GOES stood at around 3.8 MT. I don't know what that stands for, sorry, and was concentrated in stations. Growing demand for non-oriented electrical steel, or NOES, for making EV motors, that's another contributing factor, as it has led some steel producers to switch part of their production away from GOES. So true supply-side factors are part of it. That includes curbs on Russian exports. And then also, obviously, there's booming demand, both in the infrastructure side and the end-use side for this key industrial input. Joe concludes that given how much public money is being put toward the energy transition in this country in particular, it's unlikely that the demand side will slow down anytime soon, thus making the supply side expansion all that more urgent. Yes, our latest American Survival newsletter hit the streets earlier today. It features Doug Nolan's weekly credit bubble bulletin and apothecary Wendy Wilson's food for thought on tuberculosis, she calls a modern threat. Plus, I have the third installment of our series on deficits and debt. Now, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, CBO, the federal government ended fiscal year 2023 on September 30th with a deficit of $1.69 trillion. Isn't that wonderful? That resulted in gross public debt outstanding of $33.167 trillion, $26.33 trillion in debt held by the public, plus $6.84 trillion in intragovernmental debt. Now, if you adjust the deficit figure for the enactment and court reversal of Biden's student debt cancellation plan and certain other timing shifts, the deficit actually more than doubled between 2022 and 2023, from $0.09 trillion to $2 trillion. Excluding those effects, however, the $314 billion year-to-year increase in the deficit was a result of these factors primarily. Well, total revenues were $4.441 trillion. That's $455 billion, or 9% lower in 2023, mainly because of smaller collections of individual income taxes. And two, total outlays were $6.131 trillion, $141 billion, or 2% lower in 2023, due to a combination of factors, which I'll get to in a minute. But the 6.131 spending minus 4.441, gets you deficit. Now, combined outlays for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid were $255 billion, or 10% higher last year, a total of $2.8 trillion. Net outlays for interest on the public debt rose by $177 billion, or 33%, to $711 billion because of, much higher interest rates. Outlays for defense totaled $774 billion, an increase of 6.5% over 2022. I think that was $47 billion difference. Outlays of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, were $101 billion more last year to resolve the bank failures in the spring. Net outlays of the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation increased by $38 billion, driven by one-time payments to certain pension plans. And outlays by The Department of Veteran Affairs increased by $37 billion, or 14%, because of increased use of healthcare services. And interestingly, net outlays for all other programs combined, a lot of the smaller ones continued to increase a little bit. They fell overall by almost $800 billion, largely from the phase out of the major pandemic programs. Maya McGinnis, who's president of the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, said this, I'm quoting, "At a time when the economy is growing and unemployment remains near historic lows," well, headline employment, "this should have been a time to reduce deficits to help us better prepare to respond to future economic downturns or foreign crises. Instead, we're now facing the prospect of new foreign conflicts at a time when interest rates have been surging and when we've already been borrowing at a pace normally reserved for times of emergency or recession." It's been a while for the government's annual deficits to mushroom into a level of debt that many experts say is unsustainable, and that everyday Americans can only shake our heads at. The nation's debt grew slowly in the first half century of its existence. Growth in gross debt, that's debt held by the public plus the intergovernmental debt, over 50-year periods since America's founding, I find illuminating. And these figures are all in nominal or then current dollars, not adjusted for inflation. From 1790 to 1849, we had average annual debt loads of $63.1 million, fairly modest. 1850 to 1889 averaged $1.5 billion. From 1900 to 1949, it jumped to $47.5 billion. In 1950 to 1999, $1.5 trillion. A huge jump. Even huger from 2020 to 2023, $11.5 trillion per year. Now, annual average debt since the Great Recession go from 2008 to 2019 was $16.9 trillion. And the average from just the start of the pandemic through the end of September this year, $29.9 trillion average. Crazy. It's even more instructive to look at debt as a percentage of gross domestic product. Why? Well, because it shows the burden of debt relative to the country's total economic output, and therefore it's our ability to refinance or repay it. Measure also allows for an apples-to-apples comparison of our country's fiscal situation over time or multiple countries' debt burdens in a meaningful way. Now, a large nominal dollar debt is less a problem if a country has a large economy and can easily repay it. For example, debt held by the public in 1946 was about $242 billion, or 1% of what it is today. But with a deep GDP of just $228 billion, then debt held by the public was 106% of the economy, or roughly 7 percentage points higher than its current level. Now, look at debt held by the public versus gross debt. Most economists regard debt held by the public, particularly as a share of GDP, to be the most meaningful measure of debt. Debt held by the public measures the amount of debt held by entities other than the federal government, and that's traded publicly. Thus, it's relevant for understanding the extent to which debt is providing fiscal stimulus or is crowding out private investment or influencing interest rates or taking up space in government budgets, like with net interest payments on the debt. Gross debt also has some importance as a measure for the government's total obligations. With some minor adjustments, gross debt is also used to determine when the government has or will hit the congressional imposed debt limit. Well, debt first surged during the early years of the Civil War when, as a percentage of GDP, it jumped from about 2% in 1862 to over 30% a year after the Civil War ended. It took further jumps because of WW1, the Great Depression, WW2, the Great Recession, and of course, the recent pandemic. And now debt held by the public stands at $26.3 trillion, or 99% of GDP as of September 30th. But look, if you think that's high, just wait. The future is not so bright, so you can leave your shades for a trip to the beach. CBO estimates that debt held by the public will surpass the record of 106% of GDP no later than 2028, given current policies. To put that in perspective, the average over the last 50 years was about 47% of GDP. CBO says the debt will be fueled by endless annual federal budget deficits, period. In fact, CBO estimates that deficits will nearly double over the next decade, reaching $2.7 trillion by 2033. The projected cumulative deficit over that period, over the next 10 years, is $20.2 trillion, the result of a growing gap between outlays and revenues. Measured in relation to the size of our economy, deficits are going to grow from 6% of GDP next year to 6.9% in 2033, to 8% in 2043, and 10.2% in 2053, well above their 50-year average to date of 3.6%. And of course, as a result of those deficits, debt held by the public will also increase from a share of 99% currently to 119% years down the road. At that time, debt as a share of GDP will reach the highest level ever recorded here in this country and be on track to rise even further. CBO says that by 2043, debt held by the public will be 152% of GDP, and 10 years later, be an incredible 195% of GDP. Interesting. Well, look, and that, of course, assumes the debt bubble hasn't exploded by then, sending the country and our finances, the world probably, into a free fall. Now, an upward shift in long-term interest rates is putting the government on track to spend a lot more on interest payments in the coming years than policymakers thought just a few months ago. If current rates stay high for longer and future fiscal policy matches current forecasts, the cost of servicing the national debt will surpass defense spending in 2025 and top Medicare spending the following year. Oh, yai, yai, yai. Look, markets can shift abruptly, as the last few months have showed, so it's possible rates could return closer to their pre-pandemic norms in the years ahead, which would ease political pressure on deficit and debt management. So perhaps it's really unnecessary for you to hold on to your wallets anymore, right? The current generation of decision makers in Washington is doing virtually nothing to rein in deficits and the debt by closing that growing gap between spending and revenues. Instead, I say, tell your children and grandchildren to hold on to their wallets. Gradually becoming their cross to bear anyway. And boy, what a precarious cross it's going to be. Hey, stay tuned for next Monday's conclusion of this four-part series when we'll look at what happened when the government actually paid down its debt 1 year and compare what deficit debt hawks and doves say we should be doing to protect our collective financial future. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll return on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks as always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye. If I got me a wealthy